The Palestinian-Israeli conflict has been a key dividing line of international diplomacy for decades. Ever since Israel's foundation in 1948, disputes have revolved around the occupied Palestinian territories, human rights violations, and the fight for Palestinian self-determination. This struggle contrasts with the conflict's escalations and the statehood and security concerns of Israel, leading to repeated cycles of violence, negotiations, and humanitarian crises. In 1994, following the signing of the Oslo Accords, a special coordinator was appointed to oversee the UN's various programs and efforts in the occupied territories. The special coordinator for the Middle East peace process faces the daunting task of navigating a political landscape where the very process of peace is frequently questioned, contested, and even disregarded. As the ongoing war on Gaza nears its sixth month, international organizations say the scale of the humanitarian crisis has reached unprecedented levels. Civilians and humanitarian aid workers continue to be targeted, attacked, made homeless, and killed. With the backdrop of genocidal assault and suffering, the role of the Special Coordinator becomes ever more critical. Find out more as the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East peace process, Tor Wennesland, talks to Al Jazeera. Tor Wennesland, UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East peace process, thank you for joining us here on Al Jazeera. We have a war in Gaza that has now gone on for more than 160 days, more than 30,000 people killed, more than half of those women and children. I'd like to ask you about where we are right now, because there's talks about a fresh ceasefire. At the same time, there's talk about an offensive on Rafah. How do you judge this moment?
Oh, it's a very important moment. We are in a terrible situation where the war needs to come to an end as fast as possible. We are seeing what's going on the ground on a daily basis, and we have a lot of questions unresolved. That is in focus here in Doha over the next days and week. I am hopeful that the two sides and the mediator will succeed in finding a way where we can have the release of hostages and a pause in the ongoing activities on the ground.
So let's talk about those two things, the possible Rafah offensive, but first those talks that are going on here in Doha. The last ceasefire lasted a week. It was in November. My understanding of these talks is they're trying to get something that's longer, about 6 weeks. I also understand that the plan would be for female, sick and elderly captives held by Hamas and other groups in Gaza to be released in return for a large number of Palestinian prisoners. Is there anything more you can tell us about the framework here?
The only thing I want to say is that it's planned to go in phases. I will not go into any details on these issues. I'm here to talk about that and the UN role in all that and the humanitarian part of this. I really want to see the file move forward because the situation on the ground is terrible.
So what is the UN role with regard to these talks? As I understand it, you're not actually at the table. Are you on the sidelines?
I'm talking to the involved parties, all of them. For the UN and for the whole of the humanitarian system, we have, since the beginning of this war, been in constant contact with the relevant parties to up our deliveries. We need to do that for all sorts of humanitarian reasons. And we particularly need it if there is an agreement to start this process of the release of hostages. I do not think that the war will come to an end at all, and it's not realistic unless this is happening.
Lots of people will be listening to your words very, very carefully, including people in Gaza. So answer me this question. How close, in your estimation, are we to a new ceasefire?
I am hopeful, but I can't give a timeline for that. That is to be decided in the next days and week.
But at the same time, as you know, the drums of war are being sounded from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Prime Minister Netanyahu says he's finalised his plans, battle plans, for an offensive on Rafah. Now, that's a place where about 1.4 million people are sheltering. Many of them have fled from other parts of Gaza. How worried are you?
I'm deeply concerned. We cannot have an operation in Gaza with 1 million or more people in Gaza, and we cannot be able to use the access routes into Gaza we have if this is taking place. So it is for the responsibility of those who are going to conduct military operation to take that into consideration.
Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu has also said that Hamas's latest offers ahead of these talks are ludicrous. Do you think the talk of the Rafah offensive could be part of a negotiating tactic?
I'm not willing to comment on that at all. And everybody is looking after how to present themselves. And I will not make any judgment on that whatsoever.
Let me give you a quote from the Israeli Prime Minister. "We will operate in Rafah. This will take several weeks. It will happen." Those were his recent words. Given the severity and brutality of Israel's onslaught over the last 5 months, we have to take his words seriously, don't we?
I always take the words of the two sides seriously. And that also goes for Prime Minister Netanyahu.
With regard to this operation they keep talking about in Rafah, the Israeli military say they're going to set up humanitarian islands. Now, we've heard this before. We've heard them set up safe zones. And as your boss, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, has said, there are no safe zones at all in Gaza. So what should people in Gaza make of this humanitarian islands quote?
Well, they will have to decide themselves. I can assure you one thing. That is that the UN is not going to facilitate that. But what the UN is going to do is to serve the people where they are with what they need to have.
Isn't the other problem with a Rafah offensive the fact that Rafah is currently the humanitarian gateway to Gaza? That's where the aid has been coming in through. And it is only a trickle of aid. But if there was an offensive, even that trickle might stop.
I said that to you, and there is a clear consensus in order to facilitate the needs of the people on the inside. We need road access into Gaza. Anything else is just a fantasy. And we need more access than we have, and we need more access points independently from whether this is happening in Rafah or not. This is the only viable way to resume the humanitarian deliveries and the needs of the people in Gaza to be met.
As you know, there's been a new assessment announced of the humanitarian situation in terms of food security. The so-called IPC classification has come down. It says that famine is imminent in northern Gaza between now and May. And your own boss, the Secretary General of the United Nations, has said this is a man-made famine. It is, in fact, an Israeli-made famine, isn't it?
Well, let me put it that way. We are aware of this. We have been waiting for this assessment to come. It only underlines one point very clearly, that we need to be able to get into Gaza with more, from more access points and fast.
As you say, getting aid in any other way than road is inefficient. The US has been airdropping aid. We've had a ship arrive, but that ship's only got about 7 trucks of aid. The equivalent, if it had come by road. Why is more aid not getting into Gaza? And to me, I mean, I've been trying to study this and I've been asking colleagues of yours from the United Nations about this for all 5 months. And the only conclusion I can come to is Israel is deliberately preventing more aid coming in.
The main arterial roads are fairly much inaccessible. They are run down. And they need to be kind of upgraded. We cannot use this road for convoys after convoys into the delivery points. In addition to that, the whole area is very crowded and the law and order is breaking on the inside. So the delivery on the inside is very, very complicated. And that is the reason why it is taking time to reach to the delivery points. So that needs to be addressed, and we are in these discussions on a daily basis.
But you talk about the law and order point, and you can understand that. If people are starving, their children are starving, they're going to try and intercept any truck they can find that might have food on it. Isn't one of the problems the fact that when those trucks have had security convoys, when they've had police accompanying those trucks, the Israelis have targeted them?
Listen, it points to one fact, and that is that there needs to be an authority that can actually protect the humanitarian delivery. The way I see that is that we need to get that in place fast. It needs to be a Palestinian authority. It cannot be security companies or anybody else. We need to get that in place as soon as possible. And for me, that is a point that has to do with politics. We now have to start talking about the politics of what's going on and the politics on how to kind of move forward. And that politics is to have a Palestinian authority on the ground that can address these issues, protect the humanitarian delivery, and by doing that, protect the destiny of the people that are on the inside.
I'd like to talk more about that later in the interview, about the Palestinian Authority and potentially about the two-state solution. But just getting back to this point, because I know you've been doing a lot of negotiation on this humanitarian aid, there could be more crossings open, couldn't there? Israel is the one that's preventing that. There could be more inspection staff. There could be clearer inspections. There was a story recently, for example, a whole truck was turned away because there were some dates on the truck, and Israel said that the stones in the dates could be used as weapons. This is maddening, isn't it?
Listen, I cannot go into the details on all these stories that are out all the time.
They come from aid agencies who are they're probably true, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, my point is something else. We need to get these delivery systems improved so we can deliver faster and safer.
You said you can't comment on the little details, Special Coordinator, but Israel is picking up on these little details. That's why it's stopping entire trucks coming through, and that's what's preventing, in some cases, people from getting the food and medicine they need.
Well, I can tell you, the main problem is that we don't get enough in, and we don't get enough quantities in from different points of entry. That is the key. That is the key challenge we have, and that is something we need to address fast, given the circumstances on the ground and the statements that are coming from different sides on what may happen on the road.
Now, you went last month to Gaza. I know it's a place you visited very many times before, but this was the first time you visited Gaza since the start of the conflict. How did that visit affect you?
I've never seen anything like this, because some of these areas were not populated at all in the western part of the strip. And I went all the way up to Deir Bala. And I'm just kind of underlining that the congestion is massive. The accessibility to the points of delivery is superbly complicated on both the main roads, and we need to have an understanding for that, because it is possible to run stuff to Gaza on a highway, but there is no highway inside Gaza to get these things safely out.
Did what you saw with your own eyes look like the result of a carefully targeted military action consistent with legitimate self-defense?
What I saw was a humanitarian chaos in the south. And there is no other way to describe it. I saw desperate people being put in a desperate situation, and they will continue to be in that situation up until the war stops and even after, for a long period of time. This is unbearable to see. It's unbearable to handle. And that is why there is a need for taking rational decision to get it stopped.
If we weren't talking about the tragedy, the unfolding tragedy of Gaza, we probably would be talking, would we not, about the West Bank, because the situation there is the worst it's been in recent memory. over 400 Palestinians killed since the 7th of October. Last year was a record year of deaths of Palestinians killed by Israelis. And if you look at the figures this year, they're even greater than last year. How concerned are you about what Israel is doing on the West Bank?
I've been raising the red flag on this issue repeatedly in the Security Council, and obviously my concern is absolute. We have had a development of flashpoints at the West Bank with armed clashes, incursions. We have had an expansion of settlements, settler violence, demolitions, and everything that makes the life at the West Bank miserable. In addition to that, we now have a restriction of movement that is being imposed, that is really hitting the daily life and the economy on the West Bank in a very, very serious way. This is the other side of the problem. This is the other side of why politics is needed and why we need to get out of it. And the Palestinian Authority is squeezed into a corner, and the international community, with their interventions, even if they've taken actions against settlements or settlers, have not been able to change this.
Are they talking tough enough on settlers and settlements? On settlers, the number of settler attacks seems to continue to rise. I'm told your latest UN figures say an average of 4 settler attacks every single day, and the Israeli military aren't doing anything about this. They seem to be involved in some of these attacks. And on settlements, I believe from November 2022 to November last year, it's the highest number on record since you started monitoring, about 24,000 new housing units. Again, as has been going on for decades, Israel is changing the facts on the ground, making your two-state solution further and further away by building on what is supposed to be a Palestinian state.
The politics of this is deliberate, it's negative, and it's destructive. It has been going on, it's still destructive, it's negative, and it has been impossible to stop it. I clearly see that. The international community is very clear on this, unanimously. And now there are actions being taken by capitals and donors that are very clearly giving a signal here. I really hope this will work, because the situation for the people living at the West Bank is like it is. And we can never find a solution if we are creating more and more flashpoints, faster and faster. We are building settlements faster and faster, and it's implemented. This is the policy of the current government, and they have speeded it up even more. And I can only say that this is to be condemned. It is undermining any serious attempt to have a political solution to this conflict, or even getting in a direction where we can address it rationally.
OK, well, let's move to the possible political solution and the way forward for all of this we've discussed. Let me read you a quote from your boss, the Secretary-General Antonio Guterres. "We want to see the creation of conditions that will allow the Palestinian Authority to assume responsibilities in Gaza, and that is, in our opinion, the solution to allow for a two-state solution to become a reality." So let's talk about those two things one by one. First, the reinvigorated Palestinian Authority to take over. How is that going to work? The Palestinian Authority themselves won't want to ride into Gaza on the back of an Israeli tank, as it were, will they?
No, but here I think the international community needs to stand up to make the Palestinian Authority an authority that can be respected, first and foremost, by its own people, and also to take upon themselves the responsibilities both in Gaza and the West Bank.
Isn't the fundamental problem here, though, the fact that the current Israeli government and Prime Minister Netanyahu don't agree with this plan of yours, and it's also Secretary of State Antony Blinken's plan for the Palestinian Authority to take this key role, a new, as he says, reformed and revitalised Palestinian Authority? Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't want the Palestinian Authority there, and he wants to keep an ongoing security presence of Israel in Gaza. That's the fundamental flaw in your plan, isn't it?
No, it's not a fundamental flaw in the plan of the international community. It's a fundamentally flawed in the policy of Israel. Now we have a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, but again, we need to get to politics to get these things fixed.
3 months ago, I had your humanitarian colleague, Martin Griffiths, sitting in the chair where you are now. He said all voices need to be heard. I quote, the voice of Hamas and other organisations which have been involved in the Palestinian universe need to be heard. We need them to be given the opportunity to tell us their views about the future. Do you agree that Hamas, which is not just a military and political organisation, but a social organisation, that needs to have a role too?
I take due note of what was said from Ramallah very recently about the conditions for moving forward and who should have the legitimacy to have a role in any government. It's very clear that you cannot, on the back of what has been going in Gaza and on the back of 7 October, immediately accept the organizations that were a part of that to run into a governance situation. That will not fly. It will not fly with the Palestinian people. It will not fly if you're going to set up a system that can work with the international community. The discussions on how the Palestinians are going to decide how to kind of manage and discuss their own internal affairs, I leave for them to do.
But it's not going very well. They've announced a new Palestinian prime minister, who is 69-year-old Mohammed Mustafa, an experienced economist, doesn't have a lot of political skills needed, some observers say. And already, all of the other factions say he's not the right man for the job. You still have Mahmoud Abbas as the leader, 88 years old, some would say well past his sell-by date. He had a 4-year term and he's now in the 20th year of that term. I mean, this isn't what Palestinians would want if they went to the polls, is it?
The Palestinians will have to go to the polls when they can go to the polls. That is not now. We need to have a bridge now where we can reset the system so it can function institutionally. But I would say the following. We will, as an international community, have to support a strengthening of that system coming into place. That is how it is, that is how it will be, and that is how we will move forward. We will not decide whether this government will last for long or for short, but we will definitely do whatever we can to get this to work, because we have no other choice.
As we've said, the aim still is a two-state solution. Now, every month, you brief the UN Security Council, and as I'm mainly based at the UN in New York, I listen to that briefing every single month, and I listen to you talk about a two-state solution. I listened to the Palestinian ambassador talk about a two-state solution. I listened to the 15 members of the Security Council, mainly playing lip service to the idea of a two-state solution. But there's one person who never, ever mentions a two-state solution, and that's the ambassador of Israel. Isn't this the problem you have, that Israel and the current government, the current prime minister, they don't believe in a two-state solution? Go back to the time of Oslo, Prime Minister Netanyahu's questioned the whole Oslo process.
Well, just know, after this war is coming to an end, there is a new reality, and we have to look at that reality and see what it takes. I've never, in all the time I've been here, seen a divide as deep between the two sides as it is at the moment. There is no kind of togetherness factors anymore. And the reality of the whole thing is that Palestine and Israel will be separate for a while, and they need to find the crumbling way back to what that reality means. I think there needs to be a rethink on the way we approach the concept of a two-state solution after this war. How exactly that would look like, I cannot tell you now. But I'm sure that we need to look at these realities from the perspective of a two-state solution. There is no plan B to that ever presented in a credible way. We need to look at the realities as it is and find a new way of thinking on how the two states can live side by side in peace and security. That is the point of departure. Then we have to discuss the details. That's where we are today.
The diplomacy on this issue has for decades Yes, the UN's there, but it's been led by the United States. Isn't it clear now, given all the money and weapons that the US continues to give to Israel, the fact that the US representative in the Security Council on three resolutions has raised their hands to stop a ceasefire, a resolution that would have created a ceasefire, that the US is not neutral? They're not an honest broker. And I've had on this programme in the last couple of months President Lula da Silva of Brazil. I've had Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and they say, no, this needs to be an international approach. The US, they shouldn't be leading this anymore.
Well, what I will say is the following. I am, as a Norwegian diplomat, fully aware of the Norwegian involvement and the American involvement in this process and others that have been involved in support of a two-state solution.
But how about bring back the quartet? I mean, you had this body, which was the US, the EU, Russia and the UN. Maybe expand it, throw in China, throw in the Arab League and have a proper international approach rather than letting Secretary Blinken do all the running.
Well, you know, as well as I do, the geopolitics of this world. And you know, because of that, why it doesn't happen very fast. This has to do with a much broader picture than the one we have in front of us, Gaza and the West Bank. And that would continue for a while until we can get it set back again. At the moment, I must say that I'm very in support of any major initiative from members of the Council and others that will work on the line of trying to set up a different direction of the negative trajectory that is on the ground. That is the politics of today.
It seems to me that all parts of the international system on this conflict right now are sounding the alarm. You have the Secretary General of the United Nations using that very rare power under the UN Charter, Article 99, to convene the Security Council, to demand a ceasefire. That didn't work. You have the International Court of Justice, which is so concerned about genocide that it passed what is called provisional measures, which Israel has completely ignored. And now you've got the IPC warning that a famine is imminent. What is left? What's going to stop this war?
Let's go back to where we are today, Doha. Let's go back to what is to be discussed here over the next day and week. This is a key to getting to a different place from where we are now. It's a key for the Palestinians in Gaza. It's a key for Israel. And the war will only stop if we manage to resolve the issue of the hostages and getting end to these atrocities that we are seeing on a daily basis happening. It is very desperate for any diplomat who is trying to do a serious job in getting these things fixed and not succeeding. Whether you are American, UN Secretary General, or the Special Coordinator, or anyone else. We need to look at this differently now. We cannot allow this to slide. We have to kind of do better and do more. In that perspective, it will be a political mobilization that will matter, and it will be our ability to address and help the people that are suffering on this situation, whether they are family of the hostages underground in Gaza or whether they are desperate civilians in hundreds of thousands sitting stuck in Gaza the way they are just now.
UN Special Coordinator Tor Wennesland, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you for inviting me.